Good morning. The first case set for argument this morning is VOR Inc. et al. Versus Paul O'Farrell et al. Daniel Bentro is appearing on behalf of the appellant and will be arguing. And Lee Schoenbeck is appearing on behalf of Appalese VOR Inc. and will be arguing this morning. Each side will have a initial argument, 20 minutes, and then Mr. Brentrow, you'll have a 10-minute rebuttal. With that, Mr. Brentrow, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. This is an eviction action, but it's part of a larger constellation of cases and issues related to changes to the estate plan of Raymond and Victoria O'Farrell last year in 2022. Those changes are alleged to be the result of undue influence or lack of capacity by Raymond. The estate plan changes occurred prior to her death in July of 2022 and then led to a precipitous sale of most of the couple's real estate land holdings in October of 2022. Raymond's competency, the validity of the real estate sale, and the estate plan changes are being challenged in other proceedings, and each and every one of those other proceedings were already underway prior to the commencement of this eviction action. In particular, in March of 2023, in a separate proceeding, Paul brought suit against the colony and other parties to challenge the validity of the deed and seek other relief. That complaint identified undue influence, corporate capacity, legal capacity, challenged the deed as well as the attempted non-renewal of the farmland. It embraced this eviction action in every way possible. But with full knowledge and awareness of that lawsuit, and after the time for answering in that case, VOR and the colony commenced the present eviction action via service of a summons on April 17th. The tenants, my clients, promptly filed a motion to dismiss, attempted to pause that proceeding in any way possible, and were unheard in all of those efforts. It led to a very abrupt, swift eviction trial. Evidence was excluded about any of the issues that we were attempting to raise in the other proceedings. Judgment eviction was awarded, along with an unusual, unprecedented, unwarranted forfeiture provision, allowing the colony to have all of Paul O'Farrell's $1 million worth of machinery left on his property unless he vacated within 10 days. All of this was predicated earlier in June of 2022 by Victoria O'Farrell's own lawsuit, in which she attempted to halt what she was seeing in real time, a series of drastic changes to their estate plan by her vulnerable husband, assisted by attorneys that she had never met. And while she is away from him, isolated in a nursing home, recuperating from surgery. She had every intent to return home. She was in otherwise good health, but died prior to the time that she was able to pursue those claims.
So the motion to dismiss that you mentioned that you filed, was there any reason that you could not have filed the answer at the same time you filed the motion to dismiss, that you could not have filed it?
So, yes. Well, practically, I'm sure I could have done both at the same time, but Rule 12 says that when you file Rule 12 motions, you do that before you plead.
What if Rule 12 doesn't apply in this special proceeding? Does it apply? You obviously think it does, so let's hear your argument.
So there's no good reason why it doesn't apply. And in fact, you would want it to apply for all the cases in which a motion to dismiss is the remedy to keep something from going forward. Right now, if a malicious actor filed 100 eviction actions in the Third Circuit right now, alleging evictions in all sorts of ways, it's clear that these were not based upon plausible fact or law, but they demanded a jury trial. There would be no remedy. If you didn't have a motion to dismiss, you'd be stuck with 100 jury trials in the Third Circuit in order to accomplish whatever it is that these rogue litigants were asking
to
do.
I think you said at the beginning of your remarks, you said you probably could have done both, or at least that's kind of what I thought I heard you say. So if that's the case, if you could have answered and responded with a pleading and sought dismissal on any number of legal theories, why would it be that you're precluded, or why would it be that the court would be subjected to all this needless litigation without an opportunity for dispositive motion practice, if you could do them both?
Well, if you can do them both, then Rule 12 applies. If Rule 12 applies, we read Rule 12 in conjunction with the rest of the statutes. Rule 12 modifies the time for answering.
Well, if you're trumping Rule 12 over SDCL 21-16-7. That says the time for appearance and pleading
is 4 days.
Is 4 days. So it doesn't say, you know, motion to dismiss. It doesn't say answer. It says time for appearance and pleading. Pleading seems to be encompassing anything you want to say, any claim you want to make, motion to dismiss, answer, jury demand. You got 4 days to do it under that statute. And doesn't that trump? I mean, you want to put Rule 12 in front of that, but doesn't that statute trump whatever rule the court put in place under the rules of civil procedure?
So the time for pleading is 4 days. Pleading is an answer, a counterclaim, and the short list of things that are found in the rule of civil procedure defining what a pleading is.
That doesn't help, because that's the way I read it, too. I read pleading as for its discrete meaning, not a generic, this is a submission pleading. Pleading is exactly what you just said. It is that discrete list of pleading documents. But doesn't that make the Chief Justice's question even more important for you to address? Because that statute, the 21-16-7 statute, says the time for pleading is 4 days. Your pleading would be an answer or a counterclaim or whatever, but your pleading would be an answer. Why does that statute not tell you and command you to do that within 4 days?
I'm going to answer a different question first and then that one immediately right after. This only matters if we're asking whether or not I was denied the right to a jury trial, because I pled within 4 days the motion to dismiss so we can talk about all those issues.
Well, one of the things that you identified, the denial of the right to a jury trial, so I agree with you, that is germane.
And if we get to the other issues first, that doesn't matter because we do something else first. But the answer, I think, is embedded within the first sentence of Rule 12A. A defendant shall serve the answer within 30 days after service. Okay? That's a command. But it's modified by the sentence later in that statute. You shall serve your pleading within 4 days. And based upon the Hazeltine case, which is as old as South Dakota, 1897, we adopt every rule of civil procedure unless it's otherwise not capable of being reconciled with the two.
So the first letter said, the first line you say says answer within 30 days, but that's modified elsewhere in the rule. That's what your answer is?
Yes.
It's modified in 21-16-7 when it says you've got to plead within 4 days. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, what does it mean to plead? A pleading doesn't mean filing a motion. Pleading means filing an answer, a counterclaim, or you know whatever else is in that. And I'm forgetting what the rule is, but it's earlier in the rules, defining the narrow set of things that are pleadings. Rule 12A then says the service of a motion permitted under 15.6.12 alters these periods of time as follows, unless a different time is fixed by order of the court, and then it outlines that. If the concern is that motion practice is going to burden eviction actions, the solution is that the court can adjust those times. A plaintiff, landlord, can ask the court to adjust those times. But in this case, everything happened within a week. Regardless of whatever the theory would be as to how we implement these rules and make them harmonized, the motion to dismiss was filed on the fourth day. The motion was resolved within 2 days. And within the next day, we filed an answer and demanded a jury trial. So within 7 days, we accelerated this process. And so it's proof that you can use the rules of civil procedure and motion practice in a way that is completely consistent with the speed and efficiency that a landlord would demand in an ordinary eviction type of case.
Well, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about 21-16-7. Which has a very clear requirement of you've got to put your pleading in 4 days. You want to file a motion to dismiss? You can file a motion to dismiss, but you got to get your answer in and your pleading in within 4 days. And regardless of the expediency, the court can figure those things out. The court can figure out, am I going to take up that motion to dismiss at the start of trial? Am I going to set a separate hearing for that? All those things. But it doesn't excuse the requirement for a pleading. And that's what I... Not hearing an answer.
And so, Judge, I'm aware of the statute. I read the statute. In the process of doing what I was doing, I also read Rule 12A and believed, in conjunction with how this court has ruled in relation to all these other cases, that you read these together, that a Rule 12 motion would suspend that time just as long as it would take to hear the motion.
In the hierarchy of legal authority, of course, the rules of civil procedure are promulgated and adopted by this court. That's not true for 2116.7. 2116.7 is a statutory command enacted by the legislature, and it would seem to have primacy. Would you agree?
No. I would say that you have to harmonize them together, and the first section of our reply brief outlined why this court is in charge of setting the boundaries and guardrails for how civil litigation occurs. If the legislature wants to adopt statutes and use language that's perhaps not as crisp as what this court would do after a rules hearing to make the rules of civil procedure work right, this court is left harmonizing what the general intent is of the legislature with its specific needs in order to make cases work.
I'm not sure. We've got that Rule 15681A, which you cite in your brief. That seems like a harmonizing rule. It says the rules don't apply insofar as they're inconsistent with other things. So that seems to be a specific rule that yields to something that's otherwise inconsistent with the rules. Do you read it differently?
If they're patently inconsistent, yes. If we say here today that motion practice is permissible in eviction actions, then we have the duty to harmonize them. If this court says that you can never file a motion in eviction actions, we have something different.
So some motions to dismiss, you need to file before you file an answer. So like if you were challenging the court's jurisdiction over a person, and the rules say, you know, you do that. Otherwise, if you file the answer, you have accepted jurisdiction or acknowledged the court's jurisdiction. None of your claims are of that nature.
So what you learn after you get to research this for several months after the initial four-day period when you're scrambling is things that help answer that question, which is that in many jurisdictions, an eviction court lacks subject matter jurisdiction over the case if title questions are being litigated in a different forum. So it would be a Rule 12 motion that I filed that would relate to jurisdiction of the subject matter.
But would that, you think that motion requires you not to file an answer? That's contrary to your earlier answer to me.
So I don't think it requires you not to file an answer, but I believe that when I followed Rule 12A in conjunction with that statute, that it made sense to me that this is the first thing that you do is to say, this is an inappropriate forum, and if that resolves it, then that's fine.
Can you point me to anything that would have precluded you from filing the answer at the same time as you filed the motion to dismiss?
Rule 12B. A motion making any of these defenses shall be made before pleading, if a further pleading is permitted.
Counsel, before you run out of your time on this issue, I'd like you to address the relief that you're requesting. If this court were to find that the court erred in denying your motion to dismiss, what is the impact now with what has happened in the other civil suit that you were arguing this should have been a compulsory counterclaim to? So that's now been dismissed and is on appeal.
Correct.
So how do you see this procedurally playing out if we were to rule in your favor on that motion to dismiss ruling?
Your Honor, there's two answers, and I honestly, I've told somebody beforehand, I still don't know the answer. It's either that you dismiss this eviction action until the other action is completely done, or you stay this action. To find the answer, I went back to the Heiser versus Rodway case and the LPN Trust case and read them in their entirety once again, and was surprised to find footnote 2. Maybe you saw that too, which says that the court in its ruling says this is not meant to imply that this court will allow questions of title to be settled in this type of action. Quiet title actions present many collateral issues that would burden the proceeding. And then it cites to a case, Rake versus Wiseman, R-A-I-C-H versus Wiseman, 234 Northwest 665, 1931. I would have liked to have found that case prior to yesterday. That case is an identical carbon copy of this case. The Rake versus Wiseman case is it's actually a two-part appeal. The first appeal is very similar to this, where the defendant tenants are saying, we have complicated questions of title relating to a series of issues related to the a sheriff's sale and redemption process. And it's too complicated to get into all the issues, but it is a very complicated theory that they have as far as why they get to stay on the property. This court in August of 1930, releases an opinion that says, these are complicated issues, but everything that was done by the circuit court in this eviction action followed this black and white process, and we're not really sure how they can muster these claims. It seems like it's too complicated. We're going to affirm the eviction, the end. 6 months later, 4 months later, January of 1931, this court releases the second of those two opinions, in which it says, essentially, that the process that they've looked at again is realizing that this eviction process is too narrow and too speedy in which to add all these complicated issues, and so they dismissed the eviction action outright and said, go back to the other action, resolve your questions there, and then proceed with the eviction action if necessary. So that's essentially what common law would suggest this court does. In our reply brief, we identified the Minnesota rule, which is that you stay the proceedings, the eviction action, once there's a question of title. As to which you pick, I look to the legislature's guidance in 21-16-9. And he will probably appreciate, well, I don't know if he'll appreciate this, I'll call this the Bob Peasall rule. My classmate from law school is a magistrate judge in the Third Circuit. If this eviction action had been assigned to Bob Peasall as a magistrate judge, 21-16-9 would have applied, which would have said, Judge Peasall, you must pause these proceedings the moment title becomes a question and certify the question to the circuit court. Because as a magistrate judge, Bob Peasall does not have the authority to listen to that.
Is it a matter of jurisdiction?
So that one, in that case, is a matter of jurisdiction because he doesn't have the jurisdiction to hear that. But it's proof that the legislature contemplated that we would have occasions in which the speedy process governed by a magistrate judge would be completely frozen in time while a question is certified to the circuit court. And there's no indication of how long that would take. It would take as long as it takes a circuit court to resolve that. And so if that's what the legislature is pointing you to in 21-16-9 for the Judge Peasalls of the world, it seems that this court could likewise say that's what applies here, is that
it seems like a specific procedure for an exceptional class of cases that doesn't look anything like this one.
Except for the fact that there was an existing piece of litigation already challenging title. And the cases we cite in our reply brief identify that, in our first brief as well, the 13A analysis, that once you have a prior filed lawsuit about an issue, subsequent courts don't have jurisdiction to think about that issue or weigh upon that issue. If you did, you would have a multiplicity of actions, which is what is going on in this case now. You have many actions going instead of just one. If the circuit court had paused this eviction proceeding, we would then be focused on one other proceeding, the existing civil proceeding. It would be on appeal. We would resolve that and figure out whether the appeal was whether the dismissal was improvidently granted.
So you think this is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, which is to say the judiciary has lacked the authority to even undertake this in any way?
Yes. If we accept the premise that an eviction action is a summary, special, efficient proceeding, it would suggest that based upon the statutes and the general narrowness of the Heiser versus Rodway and the LPN cases, it would suggest that a circuit court judge sitting in that case lacks subject matter jurisdiction ability on the important questions of title. The footnote 2 in Heiser versus Rodway suggests that this court is reluctant to have the question of title be resolved in that process. The solution is simple. You stay the proceedings and have the question resolved elsewhere.
And it appeared your compulsory counterclaim argument was another way of getting at the same thing.
Yes.
Albeit dismiss it because it was a compulsory counterclaim to the existing lawsuit.
Right.
You know, I looked at the Rule 54B certification in that underlying lawsuit, and it appears there's language in there that says, seems to support what you were arguing there, that the rescission in that case being requested mirrors the eviction action that's currently pending. I'm curious as to how, I mean, was there a dispute about that issue in the other case? I'll let that go. That actually was something that occurred after the matters that are on appeal. So I'll withdraw that question.
I've got 20 seconds left. I think that the two words you're going to hear most from Mr. Schoenbeck are Mr. Brentrow. This case is not about me. The two words that you should hear are Victoria O'Farrell. This case is an outcropping of what she saw in real time. She is the only litigant we've been able to find who actually tried to stop undue influence as it was happening. The only case of its kind, the only litigant of its kind. This is not the action, not the forum in which to resolve this issue. This eviction action is just simply the wrong forum in which to hear these complicated issues.
Thank you, Mr. Brentrow. Mr. Schoenbeck, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, members of the court. It's an honor to be here in front of you today. If I could, let me first say, the forcible entry and detainer statute has two pillars. One is it's a tighter timetable to force resolution of the issues with respect to possession, and secondly, it limits the scope of the proceeding. And those are both relevant to what's going on here. And if I might touch on the questions that were asked, yes, the motion to dismiss could have been filed with the answer, and in fact, there's 11 Healy cases. You got to forgive me if I can't remember which one, and I think you've had at least three of them. But one of those, and it might have been the Mines one, you specifically addressed that issue because the other side complained, and you said you can file your motion to dismiss with your answer, which is what we did in that case, and you affirmed it. The question about harmonizing Section 81 of the Rules of Civil Procedure couldn't be clearer about the priority between when you have a set procedure somewhere else and you're going to try and take the Rules of Civil Procedure and overlay them. There isn't any. It is clear that the statute, the separate chapter on forcible entry and detainer, prevails. I'd like to go to that last set of questions and issues because there's a little game being played, well, big game, with terrible consequences for Raymond O'Farrell here. He says, well, we should have waited for that other lawsuit. That other lawsuit, Mr. Brentrow is claiming in that lawsuit that he represents VOR, the party that's trying to evict Paul O'Farrell, who's taken over $1 million from his parents. If that other lawsuit, VOR, was he made them his client in that lawsuit. So how is VOR going to evict the guy that's stealing money from them when that guy and VOR have the same lawyer, Mr. Brentrow? I mean, and in that same case, he's also suing VOR, asking for damages against the party he claims he's representing. It's the dangdest thing, but that was not a venue that you could do the eviction in because it wasn't even postured like that, and VOR was soon to be dismissed because he shouldn't have been claiming that he was their lawyer.
Well, that'll happen. That ruling came after, and that's now going to come before this court eventually, and that's not our issue here. But here it's what was in front of the circuit court at the time of denied the motion to dismiss in the eviction.
Correct. And in that other lawsuit, Mr. Brentrow was claiming he was VOR's lawyer. And by the way, VOR didn't own the property anymore. They had to sell it to pay off his client's debts.
Well, and again, we're getting into the issues of that case, and I think he's disputed that, and that'll ultimately come in front of us. But right now we need to focus on what was before the eviction court.
And what was before this court were, and if I dive into the issues that are there,
I'd like to ask you about something.
Perfect.
Does the circuit court have subject matter jurisdiction to adjudicate
an eviction action when it's clear there are colorable issues of title in this other action?
If I could parcel that, first off, the court has subject matter jurisdiction. It's a court of general jurisdiction. An argument that they don't is not cognizable under our laws in South Dakota. But it's not
it's
like
about
we
get possession.
Yeah, it's about
the
possession.
Eviction is about possession. But when there are issues, colorable issues of title, does the court who's trying the eviction action have jurisdiction to resolve the questions that ultimately relate to title?
Yes, but it really isn't about title. There is no title claim here. VOR owned the property. He has a separate sort of damage claim against VOR for selling, but VOR owned the property. Even under his theory, he's not a shareholder in VOR, but his theory was he was going to get to have Raymond found incompetent, going to get to take control of the corporate, be the guardian, take control of the corporate. I mean, I'm sorry I'm getting into that, but the reality is title was never an issue.
So
VOR owned the property.
As I read the complaint in that action, there was also a question with regard to his right to continue in the lease because of, meritorious or not, this, and I know there's a dispute on this, but his claim was there was an ineffective notice of termination there because of what happened with the power of attorney and the corporate structure of VOR and all of that. So it wasn't just the challenge to the underlying sale. There were also other claims at issue that seemed to relate to these immediate right to possession that pertained to the lease as well.
This
weren't there?
Not about notice. I mean, I'll give you Mr. Brentrow is entertaining and colorful and expansive in his views of things, but the facts, which are in the transcript, and it's in our brief, and I was going to quickly give you the page number 23, everything that his client admitted at the trial, there's no dispute that he got notice to terminate the lease. They kind of make an argument that since VOR gave the notice and didn't finish evicting him fast enough that meant that notice was ineffective, but that's not the law in South.
Well, and again, and this isn't the merits determination here. This is his claim is I didn't get to put on my case. And where should he have been able to get to put on his case? So that seems to be, whether it's meritorious or not, that's what we're deciding here. And what I'm trying to get at is what were the claims that were existing in that other lawsuit, and would it have been appropriate to instead litigate those issues which pertain to possession in that lawsuit or do it in the eviction?
You know, proceeding. The notice provisions under the forcible entry and detainer statute are pretty simple. It's just, did you serve that document?
No, I'm talking about the notice that was argued, the lack of sufficient notice for the termination of the lease in the other lawsuit.
Yeah, I don't even understand. I respond to it, but I don't even understand what he's talking about. I know this, and it was litigated in this case, and it's in the record. The statutory notice required in a forcible entry detainer action was served on him, and he admitted that he received it. There isn't any other notice required.
I thought Paul admitted in this trial, I thought he admitted that he doesn't have a lease anymore.
He did. Not only did he, in fact, that's the saddest one. If you look in the transcript, he signed the papers to cooperate with transferring the government programs. He looked at a lease, couldn't afford it, didn't sign a lease with the new owners who he talked to, who gave him the opportunity.
And that's all in this transcript.
It's all in transcript.
And his only claim to any right of possession would have been under the contract, under a lease.
Yes. There's no other claim except the lease, and he admitted that he got the notice terminating that lease.
Counsel, can you address the issue regarding the forfeiture of the personal property? What is your authority for the justifying the court's decision? It's not touched upon in depth in your brief.
That's because Grand Valley and BOR had a crappy lawyer on that part. The guy that drafted that proposed order, which is me, and after got that, I said, we don't have a right to that, and we've not argued that we should be entitled to that. I've dropped the claim.
Sir, you're saying that order should be vacated.
That part about the possession, yes, shouldn't.
The possession of property left after 10 days.
Correct.
So you're conceding that?
Absolutely.
All right,
yeah, no, that's correct. You get a tenor of the frustration about all of this, and that there needs to be an end to this. And of course, this is farmland that needs to be farmed, which is and as this court knows from the supersedeas bond record that you have before you, come January 1, if possession isn't delivered to Grand Valley, Mr. O'Farrell will have cost his father another $300,000 for not delivering. So this court spent 7 months studying elder abuse, particularly financial elder abuse. This is it playing out in real time for Raymond O'Farrell. I made a list of other topics, most of which didn't get dealt with on the initial argument. I'd be happy. I mean, I'll answer any questions. I would say this. The pleadings required to be done within 4 days. Even though he didn't do what he was supposed to do by the rule, the judge let him file a late answer. And on the jury trial, he didn't tell. I mean, think about the administration of this chapter and the trial court. He should have been telling him within 4 days, this is what I want. Instead, he shows up the morning of the court trial and says, I want a jury trial. And that's just not right. That can't reconcile how this chapter is supposed to work with the rules of civil procedure.
So the challenge of possession that you raised in the FED, that was not active at the time of the other lawsuit was initiated. Neither the colony nor VOR was attempting to regain possession from Paul at the time that other lawsuit was initiated.
I don't have the dates in front of me because the notice telling him that his lease was terminated was quite early on. And I can't tell you how that coincides with whether he'd already gotten that notice terminating his lease.
So the FED could have. Do you think the FED could have been filed as a counterclaim in that lawsuit?
It couldn't because VOR wasn't a defendant in it. VOR, the owner of the property, was a plaintiff with Mr. Brentro claiming he represented him. So they couldn't even defend themselves in that lawsuit.
So the caption of that doesn't list VOR as a plaintiff. It looked like it was an alternative argument that was made with regard to one of the claims, but again, that's a merits question.
VOR is named as a plaintiff in the caption. The alternative argument is what he uses to explain why he's seeking damage against the plaintiff that he claims to be representing.
You know, counsel, what bothers me, many things bother me about this case, but one thing that bothers me is that at the simplest level, in an eviction action, the question is possession. Who's entitled to possession? How does a court grapple with that when there are colorable claims about title? I mean, and so that leads me to inquire, shouldn't this have been stayed until the underlying litigation could have been resolved?
There is no colorable claim of any type about title. There is somebody who says they should be entitled to inherit certain assets when their parents are gone, which is, of course, this court says you can't make those claims in South Dakota. There isn't even under his theory, VOR owns the property. The title issue is not an issue. It couldn't get properly raised in that other case because he claimed he was representing the corporation, or he filed as the attorney for VOR. But there is no title issue. Even under his theory, VOR owns the property. He's got some kind of a damage claim against VOR that he could, if he wasn't representing him, he could be making it in that other lawsuit.
Well, there was a rescission claim in that lawsuit.
That's correct. That's correct.
And in the 54B certification, it states that his rescission claim mirrors the eviction action. So how, and that's the order that the court entered in the other lawsuit. So how is that not, that seems to be right in line with the argument that he was making that it should have been handled in that matter.
Well, the eviction was already done by the, I wasn't here to argue the other case, but that's one of the timelines in front of me. But I think the eviction was done when the rescission ruling happened, but I won't swear on that because I can't remember, but they're real close in time.
Was this an order that you proposed for the circuit court in the other lawsuit?
That rescission happened.
The 54B certification.
We proposed 54B certification. That's the question, yes.
Which states that his rescission claim mirrored the eviction action.
Okay, I didn't prepare that document, but I don't have it in front of me because I wasn't ready to argue that other case. The title is not an issue in either case, though. even if it's a rescission, it's to put it back in the ownership of VOR. It's not to put it in the ownership of Paul O'Farrell. So, and that's the really unusual thing here is, again, VOR doesn't get to be represented under his theory in that case, the owner of the property.
And in any event, it wouldn't relate to immediate possession.
Correct.
So it's not only the distinction between possession and title. Heiser says, adds an adjective there, it's immediate possession. So rescinding sales, unraveling whether Paul should have been deposed as the president of VOR, all those things are constituent parts, it seems, in a plan to, and I think the pleadings, I think the complaint in, or Mr. Rentro's, was there a complaint in this case or another one? He uses the word unravel, something like that. So those are multiple steps. But ultimately, that's going to title. This is about immediate possession.
I'd agree with that.
The only two parties that claim title to this property are VOR and the Colony.
Correct.
The Colony bought it from VOR.
Correct.
VOR and the Colony are both plaintiffs in the FED action seeking to evict.
Correct. And both VOR and Grand Valley
anyone claiming title. The only people claiming title were also seeking eviction.
Correct.
But let's say those other actions play out and they're successful for Paul O'Farrell. And he unwinds everything and wins and hits a home run. That will conceivably, the relief will be reinvesting him with title. But they could account for whatever dispossession has occurred prior to that point as a component of damages in those other cases.
That's correct. And the lift on that one where you got to give $3.2 million back to a bank, or $1.6 million back to a bank to pay off. I mean, it's I'm going to apologize. Everybody keeps bringing that other case in. That's all predicated on that Raymond O'Farrell isn't competent, and no court has said he's not competent, and they're saying he's not competent to make decisions about stock that he owns. So you can't jump all the way to somebody's incompetent so that the guy that took the money from him can proceed to a lawsuit. He's got to win something way, way, way before that, which is to take away this citizen's right owner of property.
But there are also undue influence claims not premised on competence.
Yes, but in his pleadings, it starts out, he wanted a guardianship over him. And then it would be, even undue influence doesn't change that the shares would be Raymond's to vote in his best interest to protect himself from the guys taking money from him. And in the prior cases, LPN and Heiser, they both say that you shouldn't unduly burden the FED procedure with collateral issues. It's only about issues that go to the immediate right to possession. And those cases only deal with that. None of those cases did the court say, you know what, in a forcible entry and detainer, we're going to let you go and try a conservatorship. We're going to let you try ownership of stock in a corporation who can vote the stock. Those are so far collateral that, as the court said in those cases, it would unduly burden the proceeding. This is about the immediate right to possession. This land needs to get farmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenbeck. Mr. Brantrow, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Brantrow, on your compulsory counterclaim and the idea of a forcible entry and detainer claim at all, it seems to me that if you win here, it really doesn't even have so much to do with a counterclaim or a compulsory counterclaim, because that seems kind of futile. Because if you win, as I understand your argument, there just isn't a plain, expedient means of dealing with possession. It just doesn't exist because, in this case, because it all has to wait and kind of exist in this stasis while these other things play out. So counterclaim or no counterclaim, it really doesn't exist. And I don't mean to be cynical. I'm just kind of throwing that out there. So, really not. I'm just kind of asking a question.
So I had this thing I wanted to start with, and you had the question, but actually the thing I wanted to start with is the answer to that question. There is a remedy called possession in the law, And there is also a statutory structure for speedy and immediate possession, and those are two separate things. Like, my right to get possession via a lawsuit could happen in an ordinary case. Now, the legislature is not saying that the only possible way that you can get possession to real estate is by following 21-16. They're saying the only way to get it speedy is in 21-16. And I think the difference is most landlords, 99.9% of landlords, in ordinary cases, are entitled to speedy possession, which is why that structure exists. But that doesn't mean that every last landlord is entitled to speedy possession. And that's what the line in Heiser versus Rodway that I think is most important says, that 21-16 is designed as a speedy remedy to provide possession to the person rightfully entitled to it. And in 99.9% of the cases, there is no question that they are rightfully entitled to it. In the rare case that ends up being LPN or the Heiser versus Rodway case, there is some nuance that then questions this. Or it's going to be a question of title that happens in a Judge Peasall case where it's not the ordinary case and it gets elevated. And so the difference is between possession and immediate speedy possession. And there's no conflict in the law. It's just that these landlords, in quotes, don't qualify for speedy possession because they are not ordinary landlords.
Where do we draw the line between those? I mean, does it depend on the complexity of the issues being argued that go to title?
If we think back to all the cases that we've ever seen in which a defendant tenant is able to raise something of this nature that we're raising here, I don't think that we need to try to draw the line. It draws itself. That so rarely would a defendant tenant ever have an opportunity or need for this type of defense. I wanted to point out in the
other action that you claim the FED should have been a compulsory counterclaim to, what's the nature of the title that you were claiming in that action? Who under your theory of the case, who held title if you had won in that case?
So, and again, I think there's a distinction between the FED as a compulsory counterclaim or the remedy of possession as a compulsory counterclaim. And those are two different things.
Yep. In the underlying action that you claim it was supposed to be a compulsory counterclaim of, what was the who held the title to the property under your theory of the case? Was it VOR? It wasn't. You were claiming it wasn't the colony because that should be rescinded because it was accomplished through undue influence. And then the title would have reverted to VOR, correct?
Yeah, VOR, which really is the trust.
Title. If you had won, VOR would have had title. If you had lost, the colony had title.
Correct.
So those are the only two entities that could have had title.
With the caveat that VOR is also the trust. Yes.
And then both of those entities are the plaintiffs in the FED action.
Correct. Now, if you unwind it to where VOR has title, VOR and the trust have title, the problem then is VOR being operated in a manner that is in line with its corporate governance, and is it being operated by someone who has the capacity and absence of undue influence upon him to exercise these questions? Mr. Schoenbeck is saying that he still doesn't understand the question of what happens in August of 2022.
But those aren't issues of title. VOR would have held the title.
So if you unwind it, then the question is who can then evict someone or issue a notice of termination of whatever this arrangement is. If VOR doesn't have the corporate governance steps in place and the CEO in place to effect this, then nothing has happened. This idea that I'm claiming to represent VOR and it's somehow a subterfuge or fraud, I represent a client who was the most recently validly elected president of this corporation who would have the ability to bring a lawsuit like this. This court has had, indeed, with colonies themselves, corporate governance disputes where two sets of parties claim to represent the corporation. There's nothing inherently wrong about Paul O'Farrell hiring me to assert a claim on behalf of the company. By the way, the circuit court dismissed our claim that Paul was the most recently rightfully elected president of VOR solely based upon public records available at the Secretary of State's office that say that Paul is not the president. That's not jurisprudence. That doesn't work. That doesn't make any sense. There's no factual basis upon which the court could use to decide that.
these claims are being ramrodded through, they're being ignored, and ultimately, Paul O'Farrell, Skyline, and Victoria's estate have the right to be heard, at least upon the merits of the issues. As this court will learn in one of the appeals that's on its way to it, this claim that, I think the quote was from Mr. Schoenbeck, no court says he's not competent. Well, my attempt to find out if he's competent was thwarted by the circuit court, and then I sent a note to Mr. Schoenbeck asking if his client would voluntarily submit to an evaluation, and the answer was no. And so, yes, no court has said he's not competent, but that doesn't mean he's competent. The question of how Paul has or Skyline would have the ability to use the property is not solely based upon a lease. There's testimony in one of the underlying hearings, which is Appendix 062, the long appendix attached to the landlord's brief in this case.
That's not a transcript in this case. That's not evidence in this case, is it?
It's not evidence in this case, no. But it's the question was to what other facts are there suggesting that there's the ability to use the property. Paul testified that he and Skyline and VOR operated like partners with cattle, buildings, and equipment. And so
that should have been, I mean, that does seem, well, I don't know if that goes to possession or not, but that should have been probably in this record. And if it's not, I don't know how we can review it now.
Well, under Mr. Schoenbeck's view, all of this is in. And so that's how he interpreted my request to the court to take judicial notice of these other actions, that they're all automatically as part of the record. I didn't intend that to be, but obviously if I get the benefit of that bargain, then certainly let's do that. Again, these are questions that were already in front of a circuit court that was intending or should have been intending to pursue those to its conclusion using facts and law and analysis and a jury and the whole nine yards. That didn't happen. That got thwarted. And we are left now with a shell of a decision in a case that is not going to mean much. Ultimately, that 1931 case, the Rake versus Weissman case, it is spot on for what this court is facing right now, which is that it realizes that if it affirms this judgment of possession, it's just going to complicate matters for all the other pending matters, and so that the remedy is dismissal. That's what you're facing here. You do not have the whole story. There is no demonstrated need for immediate possession. There is no obvious 100% right to rightful immediate possession. There are questions of title. Again, if this were Judge Peasall's case, the whole thing would have been stayed so we could resolve that. This is Judge Spears' case, and so the same thing would be true. If you cannot resolve complicated questions in an FED, then you pause the FED and resolve the complicated questions. That's the simplest harmonizing way to handle this. I have nothing further. If you have any more questions, I'd be happy to answer it.
What exactly was the scope of the judicial notice that you requested from the court?
We quoted it. Yep.
Now
I want it as broad as possible, but at the time I said, I asked the court to take judicial notice of the pleadings and the arguments that the parties were making, the contentions that the parties were making in the various proceedings. And so, I mean, I guess if that's part of it, then Paul's ability to claim that he's in partnership with a trust in a complicated long-term plan in which ultimately he's going to inherit the land that's being used as collateral to finance some of his operations, you know, we were thwarted at every opportunity to introduce evidence about things like that at this trial. We asked the court, I think, dismiss this case, similar to the Rake appeal, and if not, then to stay the eviction proceeding until the other matters are able to work their way through. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brentrow, and thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess till 10 o'clock.